So I guess for me, one of the key takeaway points for all of you out there who are using these CAT models is there is uncertainty, and at some point we need to quantify what we think that is. Which brings me to our next speaker. One of the things we also need to think about is there's not just one model. So the next speaker is Jeremy Waite, and he'll take us through some of the differences between models. What are the things we might need to look at? What are some of the things that maybe are covered in one model and not in another? So Jeremy's currently the head of analytics for Australia and New Zealand for JLT Re. Jeremy's had a long career of over 20 years in broking, underwriting. Jeremy's been chief pricing actuary. Jeremy obviously is an actuary, so I'd like to welcome Jeremy to the stage.
Thanks, Scott. New model developments. So I come from the first three speakers, you've sort of heard that the world's very uncertain, which we knew anyway. The models don't necessarily, we heard before, give us perhaps the best view of the understanding of what's going on. But there is good news. The models are becoming, there's a general theme of making it clearer about the assumptions that are actually in the model. So I shall begin. On my agenda, I'm going to begin at the beginning, and I think to tell you where the models are going, I've got to explain a little bit about where they came from and where they started. But I'll do that very quickly. And I'll go through in some detail about what all the main vendor models are doing, because they're doing quite a lot of work driven by our demands of wanting to know more about the CAT risk and understanding the uncertainties that our first three speakers have been talking about. And then I'll take you through into what that won't do for you as well. So Ben's alluded to it with the uncertainty, and I'm going to use earthquake as an example, so a little bit intimidated having a real earthquake expert in the room, so hopefully I won't say anything too wrong, because my background is not peril risk. I'm an actuary, I'm a user of it. My experience came from using it within Lloyd's syndicates to quantify and price risk. So the current models. So Ben's basically taking you through the basics of how a CAT model work. The core thing is your hazard model, vulnerability, and exposure data, financials about what it means for insurance terms. So I'm probably coming at it from a reinsurance point of view, because that's what I do as a living, but it's becoming more and more common to use that in your underwriting, so I'll probably cover that a little bit more, especially in Australia with the other perils that aren't necessarily modelled by the big vendor model firms. There are three main vendor model firms, and as Rick mentioned, they probably spend more time developing models for Florida because there's more premium spend there than anywhere else, really. So some of the models for Australia aren't necessarily up to date. Maybe they're a decade old, maybe the world's moved on, maybe there's new earthquake research that's not in there, but it's important to understand that when you're making risk management decisions and what you're going to do about it. Where we're going with the models is, it's driven by wanting to know more about how the models work. At the moment, they're quite black box. They can be time-consuming to run. It can be very difficult and time-consuming to work out how sensitive it is to the range of assumptions that go in. So we spend a lot of time trying to back solve what's happening in the models. The models taking that on board are making that clearer. There's other initiatives like OASIS, which I'll talk about, where it's a plug and play, so you can change your vulnerability curves, so you could do more research and come up with your own view of risk, which I think is important. GEM, the Global Earthquake Model, again, which is a massive undertaking to understand earthquake risk throughout the globe better and enhance past data that we've got. And our RMS one is a platform whereby people can build models on this platform, which won't necessarily make things easier because there'll be more views of risk. So that I think what's going to happen is we're going to be doing more work to understand the risk, which I think is good news. So where did this start? We heard in the first three speakers, they all talk about data, and that's the fundamental problem in, I guess, all model building, really, but especially natural catastrophe. So we only, as humans, started measuring things in the 1800s. You know, post-industrial revolution, science takes off. We start measuring wind speeds, ground motion equations. We might change the scales, but we fundamentally, our event set goes back that long. We can enhance it, which is what I'll talk about, Gem, a little bit later, where we're trying to enhance that data. And there's lots of techniques that we talked about earlier that you can look at the geology and work out where fault lines are. So you can enhance your data set a little bit. But in the old days, good old-fashioned underwriters used to have an actual physical map, and they'd put pins in it. And I think probably when they couldn't fit any more pins in a location, they'd stop writing risk there. So it was a very sensible way of measuring your aggregates. Then what happened actually post the 60s? I guess computer power is increasing, but it wasn't good enough to do CAT models. But it was a benign CAT period. So the vendor models began in the late 80s, early 90s. I started working at night in 92. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have mobile phones. Occasionally computers had green screens and floppy disks, and we didn't always have a computer each. So I think to get models going at that point, they're completely different. The IT side of things, I think, is important in drilling into what the models are actually doing. So the fact computers are speeding up means you can start to do a lot more work with them. And then what happened is events driven, huge losses of money. 89 had two events. We've got Hugo and Loma with 10 billion. Then 1992 was the real big one, where 15 billion of loss, nine insurers insolvent, and modeling firm, happened to be AIR, I'm model indifferent, came up with an estimate of 13 billion, which I think is actually very good. That gave them credibility, and it allowed people to start using them to quantify risk better and learn how to manage your risk. And I think it was basically the birth of the CAT modeling profession. So what's happening? There's a current change, perhaps in philosophy, from CAT risk modeling to CAT risk management. So it's the underwriting side of things. So the potentially historically, people have taken a bunch of data, worked out a CAT number, go and buy reinsurance for it. But that number can be influenced by the data that you put in, not just the quality of the data, but the actual risk that you're writing. So you can work out what your CAT risk model is going to say by writing risk differently. So it's risk management. So that's more what's happening. People that work with CAT models, with the results, we all understand how uncertain it can be. Even if the numbers aren't quite right, you can generally speaking work out whether risk is increasing or decreasing and make choices around that, even though the numbers might not be spot on because there's so many uncertainties. And I've seen that with the vendor models, set of client data a year apart, one said the risk was increasing, one said it was decreasing. Now, that doesn't bother me so much as where and why. So you get to the bottom of it, it turns out to be Perth, different views of science, which is also acceptable. So I guess the good news, there are new model platforms from each of the main vendor models, and the driver is basically people like us asking questions, how's this work, why does that work, why does that number jump around as such? And the more detail you go into, the more questions you have. It's almost a bottomless pit of detail, CAT modeling. And the driver is people want consistency. They want to be able to believe the numbers over time. Transparency, what assumptions have gone in there? How am I coding my buildings? What vulnerability curve is that? What's it based on? What's my demand surge based on? Where's the data come from? And flexibility to allow you to drill into the detail. So I think what's happening is all the models are coming at the risk from a point of view of actually getting to the drivers of that risk, which allows you to make decisions. I think that's the exciting bit about CAT modeling. I'm not a CAT modeler by trade. I like making decisions and thinking about things and thinking about risk. And the models are working, I guess, in our favor. I think we'll actually be doing more CAT modeling style work than less. So I think the advancement in IT, rather than make it easy, we can all sit down with our feet up. I think we'll be doing a hell of a lot more work because we can, and we'll be asking more questions. And the more we see, the more questions we'll ask, which will help. So RMS-1, it's an IT project, so it's been delayed a little bit. Kind of predictable. The key point about this one is it operates in the cloud. And RMS have forced you, it will only operate in the cloud. So there's various issues about privacy and security and availability. I'll talk a little bit later about the cloud later on. To deal with some of that, RMS have got a private cloud. So they've got a big bunch of servers up in Iceland. They've got some in the UK, some in Canada. There's one planned for Asia. And they've got lots of IT, lots of security, and there's lots of pros to that, there's lots of computing power. So we should be able to run the models a lot quicker and change things, run them again, see what happens. So it's the old actuarial sensitivity testing. What difference does it make? What should I do about that? How do I make decisions with that? It's quite expensive and you pay per use. Touchstone, this is the AIR version of that model. I've seen a demo of this. It actually looks very good to me. It looks a lot easier to use, and it can flick through your event set and put those footprints up on a map. So it allows you to get some sort of understanding of what's actually going on. It's a competitor of RMS. It allows you to run on a cloud or not on a cloud. It's your choice. And also, what's happening in the models, generally speaking, lots of marginal impact analyses are becoming easier and easier. So the difference in writing this one particular risk, how does that quantify? How does that add to my PML? How does that add to my annual average loss? Do I want to pay that? Is it worth it? Am I charging enough? And you can get some surprising results when you actually go into the detail of these models. Then we've got RQE. Saw a demo of this one the other day. You know, even I'm getting a bit bored of talking about cat models now, because they're all trying to do the same thing. This one's actually got some quite good reinsurance functionality. It's improving. There's lots of analyses that are still expected to come with this one. All models are not equal, but I think they're all... We should probably use them all and find out where the differences are, because I think the IT platform is one thing. The fundamentals of the model underneath that's driving it is a completely separate thing. So I think with all the models, we'll be able to understand the differences between the models a lot more. For example, on earthquake risk, I'll talk about that later when we get on to earthquake risk in Australia. And then we've got OASIS. The idea is it's an alternative. So it's got lots of sponsors at the moment. All the broken firms pretty much sponsor it, and quite a lot of other people do too, because it's quite an exciting development. The idea is it's open around the assumptions that you make to measure your risk. And I think that's what we all need to do, is get down to understanding the risk and understanding why the risk is like that, and taking a view on vulnerability curves, on event sets. So the idea behind OASIS is actually a plug and play. And Jem, the global earthquake model is not driven by insurance or reinsurance. It's actually driven by earthquakes cause a fantastic amount of damage and lots of lives lost. Between 2000 and 2010, hundreds of millions of lives have been lost because of the earthquakes that have happened typically in the non-developed countries. So the driver behind GEM is to actually understand the earthquake risk, adapt the building codes, possibly advise people on where to live and not to live if they can. But it's trying to get to the fundamentals of it. And again, it's meant to be open. And the main issue is trying to enhance the data set, which then we can use to build better models on. So for earthquake, you know, we've only been measuring things for probably 150 years or so. You can do a little bit more geology and maybe get, you know, the San Andreas Fault apparently has got about a 2,000-year track record because it's very active and you can measure it, but really GEM's trying to enhance it as far as possible so we can build better models. So the components that that Ben mentioned are all visible there. But I think you've probably got to be quite savvy, well aware of measuring cat risk and the different types of vulnerability curves with different types of buildings. So I think possibly a potential upside of this, it will allow science and finance to perhaps understand each other a bit better. So that every part of it can be changed. You could change your vulnerability curves, but I think you're going to have to learn how to program. So I don't think it's going to be a sort of plug and play that you can just chop and change. And to be honest, if you could, that would be quite dangerous because you could... model validation is actually very difficult, especially with sparse events. So the best we can do is take it into the pieces and prove each piece. But we all know from actuarial valuations that you could make conservative assumptions in two or three places, suddenly you've got a massive amount of conservatism. So you've got to be, which may not be a bad thing, but it's to do with risk appetite and understanding your risk better. So I don't think it's necessarily easy, but I think it's a good development that's actually happening, partly driven by IT being easier to use. The cloud. Basically, it's outsourced computing power. So Google and Amazon have cloud servers that you can rent, flexible capacity, pay as you go, and you can access it from anywhere. So it's basically a bit of a mobile technology, and it'll be a lot quicker to run some of the models, which at the moment can be quite time-consuming, especially when you do lots of runs to try and work out what difference it makes changing some of the assumptions in your data and your codings and things like that. So I guess the good thing about it is the cat modeling firms owns all that IT infrastructure and fixes it. There's all sorts of issues with model patches and updates and putting it on different servers. And you know, I think occasionally when they put it on a different server, they get slightly different numbers, which I don't quite get. But at least someone else is, you know, the model vendor's doing all of that for you. I guess the downsides would be the security concerns and how do you make sure no one else gets your data and hack it in. But it's the only option for RMS1. So that's a decision lots of companies will have to take. So I guess I'm trying to draw a quick summary around these, and then I'll get on to, you know, this is all good news. The models are getting better. We're able to penetrate the assumptions a lot more. So the current models are all improving, but actually RMS1, they're not going to change the fundamental earthquake model or the cyclone model that's in there. They'll just allow you to go and see what model was there in the first place, which is good, and you can start challenging it and testing it. It's also going to be a multi-model platform, so there's local, which I think is good. There's local developers like Risk Frontiers and Combus down here that will be putting their expertise and their local expertise into these models that we can choose to license. The open source one, I think, is probably a more difficult alternative. that I think you'll need probably a lot more IT expertise to do that one. So it probably won't be as slick as RMS-1, but I think it'll be feasible for people who really want to get to understand that risk a lot more. And then you've got the open platform type versions where you can change your event set, see what happens, change your vulnerability curve, see what happens. So I guess the positive news for me, I think, is you may be able to tie science together with insurance a lot more and get lots of different views of risk. But what do you do with it? What do you do with the results? So I've talked about the improved understanding of models, understanding the drivers, and the ability to change some of the assumptions. But the key skill is what to change. What we're trying to do fundamentally is separate the signal from the noise, try and work out what's actually happening. We all saw in raw data, it wobbles about a lot. We're trying to get the key theme that's coming out of it and use that to make decisions that are robust. So what can go wrong with the models? I happen to pick Japan because there's a really good paper, and we've got 9 earthquakes in a row that caused loss of life of 10 or more versus a hazard map. Now, according to the hazard map, Japan spent a lot of time and effort building this hazard map, and the southern coast is bright red, which is the scale at the bottom. Within a 30-year period, really, that should start shaking. I've got a 30-year period of earthquakes here, none of which have hit the red. So if I'd got a coin and I'd assumed it was an unbiased coin, 50% chance, and I tossed it 9 times in a row and I got 9 heads, I might well question that coin. It would raise doubts to me. And the odds are not 50-50, by the way. There's a scale at the bottom. So it leads you to, if a country with a lot of money can spend a lot of time and effort developing a model that when you validate it doesn't necessarily give you the answers you're expecting, why would that be? And it can be. Now, we had a big earthquake here. I'm not going to pronounce it. The earthquake in Japan, Tohoku, which generated a massive tidal wave. We probably all saw it on TV. Now, they built a seawall to protect against that tidal wave. They built it 10 metres tall because they assumed in their hazard map that the biggest earthquake they could get was less than a 9. They thought it was an 8. All sorts of technical reasons for that. They only thought you could get 9s where the tectonic plates push against each other very, very quickly, and they thought that wasn't the case. So that was fundamentally built into their protection. What happened is you did get an earthquake that was a 9 that was off the coast. So it was bigger than they expected. It generated a landslide, which wasn't expected. It generated a tidal wave that was probably 20 metres tall. So it's not necessarily, it's unknowns. So I guess you could call it bad physics. I don't mean that. I just mean that the real world is actually more complicated than perhaps a lot of us imagine. And I'm always amazed when physics and maths actually explains the real world. It's a very happy coincidence to me. bad assumptions that we all know this as actuaries. You give 10 actuaries a load of data, you'll get 10 different views of the risk, which is perfectly reasonable. And it's made harder in earthquakes where the data's sparse. So you might get an earthquake magnitude 9, perhaps once every 20 years or so. It's actually really hard to work that out. It's since been, the guy that wrote this paper is the guy that, he's involved with GEM, and they've changed the view that you can get a 9 because you've had one. So I'm pleased they're listening. And he also, he was talking about the uncertainty more, about how San Andreas Fault, maybe you've got 2,000 years worth of credible data there using geology, et cetera. And the guy said to him, what if you've got 10,000 years, 100,000 years, a peta databyte set, what would you do? And he said, I'd be able to tell you that the biggest earthquake is at least as big as the biggest one in the past. So it would improve your predictability somewhat, but it's still not necessarily the biggest. So I'd call that the supreme hub. It tells you the biggest, lowest, biggest bound. And I guess you've got bad data that different ways of collecting the data. So the climatologist might view it differently to the physicist in terms of how you bring it together. Bad luck. Just because you've got 10 heads in a row doesn't mean the coin's biased. Anyone want to bet with me later? It could be random, but the too many bad black swans, when things happen that you're not expecting. So the Christchurch earthquake was on a blind fault. So that can still happen as well. So you could call that model miss. That's not going to change. There's a lot of things coming and going. And also, I draw your attention to the... I was quite fascinated by this. Plate tectonics was only developed in the late 60s. The guy that discovered it, Frederick Vines, is still alive. So it was late 60s in Cambridge, and it wasn't well accepted. Even though it looks like India and Africa kind of fit together, the prevailing theory was land bridges that came up and down, which no one could quite explain, but that was the prevailing theory. So plate tectonics wasn't immediately accepted. In fact, the Americans, I hope there's no Americans here, said it was impossible. in the 60s, but now it's accepted. So it's still I'd say a relatively new science with sparse data. So it's always going to be quite hard. So here I've got a map of where the actual earthquakes have happened in Australia. I'll just put it, because it's quite fascinating, it's real data that you've got. This represents all the magnitude fours and above. So there's three, if you look carefully, three different sizes of dots. The big ones are a six, the smallest ones are between a four and a five. And you can see where fault lines are. So we saw, luckily that ties in with the earthquake expert, thank you, thankfully. But because it's real data, that's probably where you work out the fault lines are. But you see fault lines without dots, you see dots without fault lines. I think it's actually very difficult. There's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of randomness. There's a lot of assumptions in these models that that need challenging. You know, the Poisson assumption we talked about earlier on, that's a nice mathematical distribution, very easy to derive, very satisfying. If you assume things are independent, proportional to time, and the probabilities are small, a Poisson distribution pops out, but it doesn't work. You know, occasionally, things do get clustered, which the Poisson doesn't necessarily deal with. There is a lot of randomness out there. And we can see how scattered the data is. So I'd say that the models are getting better at understanding what the models are doing, but it's actually very hard to work out. That there's considerable interpretation and skills and judgment and a lot of work needed to go in to make proper decisions from these things. So what models are available? Well, earthquake and cyclone, all the vendor models, and locally there's the Risk Frontiers version. The RMS one, I think 2005 it was done. Climate's changed in that time. Maybe that one would need an update, which won't be happening because they're busy doing their IT platform. But there's lots of other perils that that are relevant for Australia. So I've, in true actuarial style, I've taken the same data and got some slightly different numbers to Will. My proportions are slightly different, but the underlying signal is the same, that cyclone's a big one, hail is a big one, top two perils, 50% for cyclone and hail. The other perils, storm, flood, bushfire, no vendor model, there's other versions of the model. So I think potentially a good thing about the platforms is that we'll get different versions of those models that are available. A similar Will-style graph about how it varies by year. There's various, you know, there's an average you could work out, very volatile. I'm not going to go into too much detail on that, but I guess for Australia, there's lots of perils that are not modelled by the big vendor firms, probably because they make more money, because there is more money in Florida. Who can blame them? So for cat risk management, basically we're going to understand the uncertainty better. And then make changes to do with that. So if one model says your risk is increasing, one says it's decreasing, you've got to understand why that would be, where that is. So risk management, avoid, mitigate, reduce, transfer. Do you do something special with your earthquake risk in Perth? Do you stop writing there? Do you write more? Do you put sublimits? You've got decisions to make. Do you offload it on someone else because you think they're underpricing it because you know what model they're using? There's all sorts of strategic decisions that you can make which will be easier to understand where the uncertainties come from. But I would say I like models, but I think you've got to apply a lot of common sense to them, which I guess is, as actuaries, we always do that anyway. So you always roughly have an idea of what the answer is going to be, especially when you're redoing a piece of work a year later. So I think we've got to blend it with other approaches. I'll talk about model blending. That top quote I think is great. In theory, there's no difference between theory and practice. In practice, there is. This is Yogi Berra, who's actually an American baseball player. He says lots of very sensible things. Just because, and this is, we talked about this, the Warren Buffett quote actually began, I guess, with William of Ockham, who was a monk in the UK about 1,000 years ago, said, when you're faced with two models, one's more complicated and one's simpler, and they both have the same explaining power, pick the simpler one. Sounds like common sense that... more IT platforms isn't necessarily going to give you a better view of the risk, but at least you'll understand where that view comes from better. And even if the notches are wrong on my ruler, I can tell if things are growing or shrinking. If I've got two different rulers, then I've got a decision to make. I want to know where they're differing. So that's my advice, is do a lot more work on your cat risk. APRA's 1 in 200 is just purely a minimum. It's very uncertain around that level. Think about how it applies to your portfolio, change your portfolio, think about it a lot more, do a lot more work. And I guess just moving on to IT a little bit, that you know, I started working, they weren't networked and all that kind of stuff, but Bureau of Meteorology releases cyclone tracks, predictability of weather. We can upload them. I mean, these guys are the experts at predicting these things. This is where a cyclone track could go. You can work out what houses it could be very quickly. You can ring people up, tell people to get out, move, whatever, prepare, manage the claims. You can use software like this to tell your claims guys where to go, and you can track them on their iPhone and say, you've been there 2 hours too long, move on. So I think IT is actually helping us manage our risk better, which is the theme I was talking about. It's not necessarily cat risk modeling, it's cash risk management and what you're going to do about it. And the realistic disaster scenarios that we've mentioned, that the 1 in 200 will be a probability number off a curve. It isn't a particular event. I think it's very worthwhile doing an actual event. What could generate that size of loss, and how does that apply to your portfolio, and how does that compare relative to your industry? So it basically backed up common sense. So I'm just going to draw it to a close now. I think we're going to take questions as a group right at the end. So I think I'm on time. A new modelling hope. That there's potential customer demand that we've perhaps over-relied on models that we don't necessarily fully understand the workings of, and that there are occasions where the model vendor will change the model, and suddenly what is a good optimised portfolio of risk turns out to be a bad optimised portfolio of risk. So I think the models are going to make it clearer on what assumptions have gone in there, what the changes are, and you can take more of a view on that. So the key theme is we're trying to understand the risk now, not the models. And I think all the models have taken that on board and are opening their assumptions up. I guess on the hard side of the equation, there's going to be more models for sure. And it's very hard to choose between them. It's very hard to validate them because the data is sparse. But I think what we're going to have to do is take more time and effort in understanding our own personal view of that risk and testing it where we can. So I think the more work will be on challenging and testing the models backed up with common sense, realistic disaster scenarios. We will own our own views of risk a lot more. And I think locally it could generate us, because we've got modelling firms that will be developing models particularly for our region, where we've not necessarily been well served outside of earthquake and cyclone, and even potentially they need updating more frequently than perhaps the modelling firms recognise. I don't know where that quote came from, a fool with a tool is still a fool. But the next generation of models will improve our ability to understand the drivers of the model risk. But still bear in mind that alternative views are possible, and we've heard about all the uncertainties actually in the fundamental science. So I'm not qualified as an actuary to choose between different ground motion equations. Very, very few people are, but at least we'll know what difference it makes and therefore can make risk management decisions about how uncertain we want to, you know, our own portfolio, where we want to grow and shrink, depending on where the actual uncertainties are or where the disagreement in science is. And I think the emphasis will be on cat risk management more than the modelling. So it'll be influencing what the models are going to be, knowing potentially what models reinsurers perhaps use. You might choose to alter your portfolio and get cheap capital. There could be all sorts of more clever things that we can start to do to understand risk. And I think that has been done. Thank you very much.